in South Vietnam's capital city of Saigon. All night the shells had fallen on or near the presidential palace, where President Ngo Dinh Diem and his advisor brother Ngo Dinh Nhu refused to surrender.
It's November 1st, 1963, and a coup is underway. It's not the first time dissident generals in the South Vietnamese army have tried to topple the Diem regime, but this time, with American help, they'll succeed. From Public Radio International, this is LBJ's War, the story of how one of the most gifted political figures of his time lost his way in a war he didn't start and didn't end. I'm your host, David Brown, and this is Episode 1.
Monday, November 4th, 1963.
That's the voice of President Kennedy dictating a private morning-after memo for the White House files. At this point, Lyndon Johnson is still the vice president, but as we'll see, the coup will cast a long and fateful shadow over the Johnson presidency.
Over the weekend, the coup in Saigon took place. Culminated 3 months of conversation about a coup, conversation which divided the government here and in Saigon.
In Washington, the division is more or less between the State Department and the Pentagon. State, under Dean Rusk, in favor of supporting the coup. The military, under Robert McNamara, opposed. And if you're wondering where Vice President Johnson figures in this debate, the answer is, at this point, he doesn't.
The problem for Johnson was, by 1963, he had been more or less cut out of Vietnam policy and of foreign affairs in general by Kennedy.
That's Dartmouth College history professor Ed Miller, who we recruited to help us parse this story.
Kennedy really didn't trust Johnson. And so, therefore, Johnson didn't have a major role in most of the meetings that took place on Vietnam in 1963.
JFK's dictated report is characteristically low-key, but the story's taken an ugly and unexpected turn. The coup that Kennedy expected, simply to topple Diem and his brother from power, has ended with their brutal execution.
I feel that we must bear a good deal of responsibility for it, beginning with our cable of early August in which we suggested the coup, a period in my judgment that wire was badly drafted.
The August 24th cable is the moment at which U.S. policy towards the Diem government changes. Up until that moment, the U.S. policy towards Ngo Dinh Diem is very strong support for his government. As of August 24th, the policy shifts to, if there is an opportunity to promote a coup, which we think has a good chance of success, then we will support that.
Whatever it was that drove JFK's decision on the coup, there's no indication it was linked to any larger thinking on the issue of Vietnam, which in 1963 was barely a blip on the radar in the U.S.
I don't think that Kennedy had made a definite decision about what he was going to do in Vietnam long term. More than most of his advisors, he realized that Vietnam had the potential to go really badly for the United States. But he didn't know what to do in response to that. So his default mode was to try to put off the hardest decisions for as long as possible and to try to keep his options open.
But as it happened, JFK never had to make those hard decisions. 3 weeks later, he would meet the same fate in Dallas that President Diem had met in Saigon, and the troubling question of what to do about Vietnam would pass to Lyndon Johnson. For the moment, though, it was JFK who had green-lighted the coup and who now had to deal with its unintended and unhappy consequences.
I was shocked by the death of Diem and Nhu. I'd met Diem many years ago while he became increasingly difficult in the last months. Nevertheless, over a 10-year period, he'd held his country together, maintained its independence under very adverse conditions. The question now is whether the generals can stay together and build a stable government, or whether public opinion in Saigon will turn on this government as repressive and undemocratic in the not-too-distant future. Period.
JFK's fears were to prove uncannily accurate.
Within a few months after the coup, the South Vietnamese government began to come apart at the seams. There was another coup in January of 1964. The Viet Cong make huge gains in the countryside. On the other hand, although Diem had stayed in power, by 1963, there are aspects of his policy and his outlook which in retrospect looked pretty delusional. Certainly his expectation that he was on the verge of winning the war, that is not supported by the evidence.
It didn't take very long in Saigon to come to that conclusion, that we were dealing with an absolute sinking ship.
In August of 63, with rumors of a coup circulating, the State Department had sent its ace Vietnam watcher, Paul Kattenberg, out to investigate. Kattenberg had met with Jim, whom he'd known for a decade, and with Henry Cabot Lodge, the U.S. ambassador.
Lodge was absolutely persuaded it was going to be a coup. What Jim knew, I don't know, but he appeared to me to be off his rocker. He was absolutely obsessed with the communists being after him. Not his general, but yeah, the communists.
The day after his return to the States, Kattenberg found himself in the room when the National Security Council met to discuss the impending coup and what to do about it.
It was technocratic talk instead of real serious political thinking about how to handle this. It would have been far, far better if we'd had a meeting of area experts who knew the region and knew the forces in contention.
Normally, a staffer of Kattenberg's junior rank wouldn't have spoken in so lofty a gathering, but he was just back from Saigon, and he was asked for an assessment.
I said, all other things being equal, maybe it'd be better if we just left with honor. I really did think that, and I thought the more the year went on, 63, the more I thought it.
Later, Kattenberg's remark that the U.S. military should simply pack up and come home would be remembered, even celebrated within the foreign policy community, as something of a profile in courage. But at the time of the meeting, the idea of an American withdrawal from Vietnam was, to many in the Kennedy administration, unthinkable.
The first one, as I recall, to react to this was Johnson. You know, Johnson was very much a kind of a warrior type. He wasn't going to give up. We haven't gone this far with this whole thing to give it up now.
So at last, Lyndon Johnson enters the picture. In fact, it appears that the NSC meeting was Johnson's first briefing on the possible coup. Samuel Gammon, a mid-level State Department staffer, recalls the vice president didn't much like what he heard.
He took a very dim view, as he told me after the meeting. So this is cops and robbers stuff. He felt the fact that we knew about it, we obviously could have discouraged, and we should discourage it. Diem may have been a son of a bitch, but he was our son of a bitch, sir.
One of the greatest mistakes that this country ever made was when we encouraged the South Vietnamese to assassinate this president.
This is LBJ, many years later and long out of office, in a private recording intended to lay the groundwork for a memoir.
In 64, the biggest worry about Vietnam was that we couldn't get a stable government, that we had made a serious mistake assassinating Jim, or encouraging or allowing it to be done. Well, we turned her back, and I think we really did more than that.
LBJ is hedging here on exactly what role he believes the U.S. played in Jim's assassination. But in 1966, while still in office, Johnson had given Senator Eugene McCarthy a somewhat darker account.
They started with me on Jim, you remember. Yeah. He was corrupt, and he ought to be killed. So we killed him. We all got together and got a goddamn bunch of thugs, and we went in and assassinated him. Now, we really had no political stability since then.
So is this rather startling view what LBJ actually thought had happened? Historian Ed Miller thinks not.
So when Johnson in 1966 says, we killed Diem, I think he's talking about the sense of responsibility in the same way Kennedy had. I think that Johnson was acknowledging that there were officials in the Kennedy administration who were encouraging the coup, who were doing their best to promote this coup. He's also making it clear that he was opposed to that decision. And in fact, he was, and continued to believe to the end of his days that it was a huge mistake.
Johnson's enduring distress over the murder of Ngo Dinh Diem has a backstory, and it's personal as well as political. The two men had met in May of 61, when Kennedy sent his vice president out to Asia on a trip that LBJ suspected was just an excuse to get him out of town.
He fought, he kicked, complained. You could hear him bellowing all the way from the Capitol to the White House.
George Reedy, LBJ's press secretary, was along on the Vietnam trip, which to Johnson's surprise turned out to have a real purpose.
Well, what Kennedy wanted was a top presence to come down on Diem like a ton of bricks and tell him that he absolutely had to institute some reforms in Vietnam that he could not get by in the dictatorial manner in which he had been running things.
Meanwhile, in Saigon, Vice President Lyndon Johnson pursues his fact-finding tour for President Kennedy. He announces an eight-point program for U.S.
From a public relations standpoint, the trip was a tremendous success for Johnson. The crowds turned out and they really throbbed to him. I remember the headline on the New York Daily News was "Veep Wows 'Em in Saigon."
Right from the outset, Ziem and Johnson took a liking to each other. Johnson, especially in public, was not just complimentary, but effusive about Ngo Dinh Ziem.
It was LBJ in one of his more extravagant moods. Mm-hmm. I think Ziem had said yes to everything that he'd asked for. Mm-hmm. And therefore, he assumed, my God, this is a great man and my friend.
Back in the day, the New York Times reported that Johnson referred to Ziem as the Churchill of Asia. Pretty effusive stuff. But the line stuck. And in years to come, lots of LBJ critics would point to that Churchill remark as evidence of LBJ's naivete when it came to international matters. According to Johnson, it was fake news.
In all my speeches to the Vietnamese, I frequently referred to the fact that Churchill, standing alone after France had fallen, had provided the courage and the resistance that stopped Hitler. And that I thought that Ziem was confronted with a similar situation, and that the events in that area of the world were going to require some strong person to do what Churchill did. And he said that we'll meet him in the beaches, and we'll meet him in the alley, and we'll meet him in the streets. And I pointed out that story to Ziem and said, so you're going to have to meet him in the mountains, and you're going to have to meet him in the forests. And if everything else fails, you're going to have to be like Churchill. You're going to have to use your beer bottles on him, because we cannot let communism take Indochina.
The line about their beer bottles is urban legend, by the way, something Churchill was rumored to have whispered off mic at the end of the speech.
Now, the New York Times, in typical fashion, and others of liberal tendencies who disapproved of Ziem, immediately said that Johnson has called Ziem the Churchill of Asia, which I did not do. I said that Ziem will have to rise to the occasion and provide the same quality leadership that Churchill did when he was confronted with a similar problem, making a difference whether it's a fascist aggressor or a communist aggressor. You people have got to stand up here and show some steel, not be the Chamberlains of your time, but the Churchills of your time.
Whatever Johnson said or didn't about Ziem, what's notable 50 years on is how passionate he was on the subject.
It remained for Churchill, who had warned all through the years of these great dangers and the necessity for being equipped to deal with them, and whose advice had not been taken, to provide the inspiration and the courage to successfully resist this aggression.
Pretty hard to miss the wishful inference here. As Churchill had stood up to aggression in Western Europe, so it fell to Lyndon Johnson to do the same in Asia. In the years to come, this refrain, forged in Johnson's pep talks to Ziem in 1961, would crop up again and again. Ultimately, the deep, almost visceral need to show some steel, to be Churchill the warrior rather than Chamberlain the appeaser, would paint the president into a terrible corner, knowing the war was a disaster in the making, but unable or unwilling to walk away.
I'd be the first American president to put my tail between my legs because I didn't have the courage to stand up and support the policy of two other presidents. On the other hand, I didn't want to increase our commitment. I didn't want to escalate. So the result was, I did everything I could to avoid the commitment that ultimately I had to make, either run or stand. And I just chose to stand.
As the war engulfed Johnson's presidency, he would keep coming back to the Ziem assassination as the moment when it all began to go south.
He was deeply shocked by the overthrow of Ziem, very deeply shocked.
This again is LBJ's press secretary, George Reedy.
The man was terribly distressed about it, and sort of hinted that Ziem had been deliberately killed under Kennedy instigation. It led to some of his first open criticism I ever heard him make of the Kennedy administration. I think that he felt that he had made a personal commitment to Ziem, and this was the way it was answered. But I think to some extent that it may have influenced him into believing that he had a commitment for keeping South Vietnam free of communist troubles too.
Whatever JFK's role in the death of Ziem, Johnson came to see the assassination as a mess made by his predecessor, but left for him to clean up.
He was not very gracefully telling everyone at that time it was all President Kennedy's fault, not his fault. And that if we encountered a disaster there, it would be Kennedy's disaster, not his disaster.
Joseph Alsop was one of the most influential columnists of his day, and a close friend to both Kennedy and Johnson. As you may hear in the background, he also kept a noisy flock of pet birds in his Washington townhouse.
And I said this is historically and in every other way wholly inaccurate, which it was, and that he, as President of the United States, still had exactly the same options that President Kennedy would have had, and it was up to him to avoid defeat if defeat was to be avoided.
50 years on, historians are still arguing over the question of whether JFK, had he lived, would have done something different in Vietnam. What is clear is that LBJ's path was largely determined almost from the beginning, not by external circumstances, but to a considerable degree by his own character and worldview.
My feeling was that the time that Mr. Johnson could have been influenced was no later than 62.
Roger Hilsman was a senior State Department staffer, a proponent of the coup, and one of the architects of the August 24th cable.
I have the impression that when Johnson became president, his mind had been made up, that the people he was going to listen to were the guys with the military hard line. I don't say that he had determined on escalating. I don't think he did. But I do think that he had made up his mind not to listen to the guys who argued that it was a political problem and not a military problem.
That is, listen to the guys who had argued against the coup and ignore those who had argued for it. Now, there is, of course, no way to know for certain whether Hilsman got this story right. Either way, in the end, LBJ would lose Vietnam. To be sure, he would avoid the humiliation that was Neville Chamberlain's fate, refusing to quit even when it became clear that victory was unattainable. But the triumphant Churchill ending that he so passionately urged on President Jim and so stubbornly pursued himself was not to be, as we'll see in the next installments of LBJ's War. For Public Radio International, I'm David Brown.